DB.
I collected some photos and videos the other night at your gig in Seattle.
Oh, right on.
I'll throw it into a Google Drive and send it over to you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you again for coming out. That was really cool of you.
Oh, it was so fun, man. Great show. Great time. Seemed like everybody really got into it. Had a great crowd.
How do you like that edit? Welcome to Made for Music, brought to you by Stitch Records. I am your host, Duncan Byerjean. For those of you who are new to the podcast, we aim to depict a comprehensive picture of the music world from the artistry to the business, so you can discover the resources available to you and learn about the stories behind the people making things happen. If you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. Sign up for the newsletter at madeformusicpodcast.com and be the first to hear about all new content, alumni news, and insights into the ever-evolving music business. As I mentioned, this podcast is brought to you by Stitch Records, founded by my good friend Aaron Karstensen, aka Cross Stitch. He has produced every single song I have released as DB Stewart. He has a background in sound design from Berklee College of Music, and truly the only person I trust with my music. No one will get you a better sounding mix than him, and the fastest way to get a hold of him is on Instagram under the handle xstitchmusic, where he also has a lot of short form production and mixing tutorials, and he's got a link tree in that bio that points you to all his long form courses as well. With that said, I bring you a long overdue release, the next episode of Made for Music, recorded back in 2022 with my good friend Brian James. Welcome to Made for Music. Today's friend of the podcast has carved out quite the journey. Growing up in Montesano, about 90 minutes west of Seattle, he took to songwriting at just 12 years old, which led to a full-time pursuit of music just 4 short years later, where he joined the Pure Prairie League on the road for 3 months. In 2005, he found his way to Nashville, signing his first publishing deal just a year later, and after many commercial independent cuts alike, he moved back to Seattle and started TSDC Music Group, his very own publishing company based in the Pacific Northwest. And we haven't even got to present day. So ramping up for summer 2022, he's gearing up for more than 50 shows with stops at the Snohomish Summer Concert Series, Rocky Pond Amphitheater, and the national anthem for the New York Mets. So without further ado, please welcome an avid baseball fan, the man behind more than 1,000 songs, 1,000 shows, and 1,000 melted hearts, Brian James.
That was great. That was great. What a great intro. Thank you for that. That was fun.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's exciting to have you, and I'm excited to dive into all this.
Oh, I'm so excited. Yeah, me too.
I guess before we dive in, I mean, obviously a very musical career early on. Do you mind walking me through the role that like music played in your life growing up?
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, music was always something that was always present in our house. I think, you know, literally from the moment we'd wake up, there'd be music playing, whether it be mom in the kitchen cooking or maybe someone cleaning the house or doing something, you know, there'd always be music in the house. And so, you know, it's always something that was very attractive from a young age. You know, it's something that I've always wanted to even pursue. I even knew as a kid that this is something I wanted to fully pursue all my life, and I feel very blessed to have gotten to this point and been able to do so this far.
What made you pick up the guitar then? And it sounds silly to say, I, for example, played piano to start and was like, oh, this is fine, but it was the guitar that made me personally realize that I could connect and make the music that I was passionate about. Do you mind walking me through what led to guitar and songwriting?
I was always a distracted kid, we could say. Always had a hard time with school, always had a hard time, you know, kind of focusing on my attention on one thing long enough to actually... We went to a concert at the fairgrounds. It was a Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. I asked, you know, after the show, the musicians, they were just kind of hanging out there at the fair. And I asked them what they would give advice-wise to a young and up-and-coming musician like themselves. And the lead singer, he said, at the end of the show, he turned around and he said, son, I want you to look at the drummer. I want you to look at the keyboard player. And he says, and I want you to look at the guitar player, and I want you to tell me who has more fun at the end of the night loading out. So sure enough, I it made sense, you know. Yeah, let's go with the guitar. And similar to you, I also learned, I had a wonderful music vocal teacher when I was younger that was also a piano player and got me kind of invested in that, teaching me the basics, you know, form and structure and some of notation things. And then my dad had an old drum kit, so I played the drums for a long time and really really started that before I ever picked up the guitar. But when I turned 12, to kind of circle back, you know, my parents, they were concerned that I couldn't focus on things until I picked up a guitar. And we lived on a farm, so I would string it up with twine from the baling hay, you know. And I would try to string it up because I didn't know anything about instruments, you know. But I had this cheap little, you know, dime store guitar, and I was trying to tune it up, and I actually did, to where I was making notes with that baling twine. And my dad and my mom just looked at each other and they said, you know, this might be something more serious. I think he really, really wants this, because look what he's doing with it, you know. So they really encouraged me from a young age and were absolutely instrumental in my success, I'd say, and allowing me the freedoms and, like I said, encouragement to develop that ability.
That's crafty as heck. I can barely string my own guitar with like Ernie Ball stuff, so that's like super, super impressive. When you got that thing working, what was it you were like wanting to play? Was there certain artists or songs, or was it just I made noise and I'm gonna figure this thing out?
You know, I back then I really didn't know anything. I didn't know theory. I didn't know composition. I didn't know. I mean, I knew the songs I liked, and but I could never get that guitar the way it was to ever make that sound. So I just tried to make notes as best I could, and I was able to, you know, with the internet being what it is, and I was able to just look up how to form certain chords, and then my dad he bought me an Epiphone guitar that was really big, and I remember it would hurt my arm to try to hold over the acoustic part. You know, my shoulder and arm would hurt until I grew up a little bit more. But then I went in and took about two guitar lessons, and after the second one, I was like, I think I got this. You know, I think I can figure it out from here. And then it just took off like a wildfire. I was, every day I would play for, I mean, hours, like I woodshedded for 5, 6, 10 hours. I didn't want to put it down ever. I loved it. It was my favorite instrument, my favorite toy. It was the best thing ever.
I know a lot of folks that got into the guitar and played for hours and hours, but how'd you know how to transform that into a career? Because at 16... you're on the road. So do you mind walking me through the jump and what that looked like?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Before I played, you know, any instruments or even wrote, I would do, talent shows, like talent competitions. Cause I've always sang. My grandpa kind of really, was instrumental in that. My dad, I think, was nervous. He's not very much for being out there in the center, you know, the center of the room, the center of attention. And so he, my grandpa was like, he'd heard me singing some Disney songs, and I was doing not just the song, but I was doing all the voices. So I had that, I guess, vocal agility from a young age. And my grandpa recognized that, he picked up on it, and he was like, we gotta nurture this a little bit too. And my dad was like, nah, I didn't need to be up there singing to people, you know. My grandpa was just like, shut up, Bill, sit down, got this. And he put me up there, and little by little, I started doing more. I wanted to develop that skill as well, performing in front of people. And And so my parents would enter me into like talent contests. So from a young age, I was in talent contests, and I was winning, you know, like multiple, like first, second, you know, rarely third, but I was really, you know, I had like, you know, just like those, at the county fair where you got all those ribbons, like I had those all over my room, you know, and trophies and stuff. I didn't want it to just be a hobby. I wanted to know, more about, how to take it to that next level. And so I start, you know, growing up, I was homeschooled. So I was able to invest a lot of my time, into learning, especially since I graduated, high school when I was 16. I was able to spend two, three, four years, before I ever turned 20, taking college courses and learning about, I read a great book from Donald Passman called Everything You Need to Know About the Music Business. And there's several wonderful variations of that throughout the year to kind of upgrade as times change, as the music industry and all industry, for that matter, changes. They kind of keep up to date with that. And I believe he's still a professor of music down in California. But I read that book when I was 16 and learned as much about the industry as I could, what branches of it I would fit into with my own personal passions for life, and then really worked on developing those skills at a young age to be able to perform and do it full time as a career. It was definitely something that I wanted to focus as much time and energy on as possible.
You're reading that in great book. Everyone that wants to move into the music business in any capacity has got to read it.
Sure.
Was it the fairs in the competitions that introduced you to the Pure Prairie League, or did you seek them out? Like, how did that come to fruition? Because I still just can't wrap my head around hopping on the road at 16 like that.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. There was a guitar player for him. His name was Gene Sibbett, and he invited me on the road to come and play some like rodeo dates that they had, you know. And I think it was more just like he'd seen me at one of those talent contests. Maybe it was like what do you call those, like a theater, a show. And he'd seen me in that, and I'd heard, you know, they had those they had those compilation discs back in the day. Like, they would always air it like at 3 a.m, you know. And for the longest time, I always used to think that those songs just, that's how they sang. Like, they were just, they all ran together like that, because I didn't know those songs until I was older. But anyways, I'd heard that Pure Prairie League on one of those highway, you know, songs. And I thought, oh man, I love that jam. That's a great song. So I learned it, and it just ironically turned out that the guitar player was at this show. And I was a young guy, maybe 16 years old, and I was playing it, and he offered to play as well, the lead, that
oh, so it was Amy.
Amy, yeah, sorry,
right. Yeah, on. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And so yeah, I learned Amy, and afterwards he asked me, you know, if I would write a song, and I asked him how. I didn't know how, you know. And he said, well, you know, it's like you got to have a hook, and you got to have a chorus and a bridge, and watch all of your, you know, watch all of your adjectives and all these things and syllables so I went home and I wrote a song called something like 13 clocks on my wall but no time on my hands, and I brought it back, and you know, it was like very early, but he was really drawn to it, and that's also what led me to my first record deal with Nashville Records, because Gene was also the owner of that label. And yeah, man, it's amazing when you look back at it all. You feel like you've lived 100 lifetimes. You know, every summer equals a lifetime almost. You know, you can identify each year by the soundtrack you played. It's quite something. But yeah, that's how I got ended up out there on the road with them for a couple months, about a month maybe, I guess. And yeah, and then I came home, and from there I knew I wanted to go to Nashville. Nashville was always my destination. I grew up watching Garth Brooks do his thing, and that was always something that appealed to me. His stage presence was just always so electric. And Willie Nelson, I've always loved Willie and his songwriting. People rag on his voice, but I love it. I think it's as unique as he is. And you know, Phil Vassar, John Mayer, gosh, I mean, there's so many to name, but I would really, you know, John Mayer was there in Georgia, so all of these kind of country acts were coming out of Nashville that I really connected to, obviously growing up on a farm and all that, but I knew Nashville was the place I wanted to go. So from the years I was about 17 to 20, I knew that was going to be the thing. So I wrote as many songs as I could. I practiced as much guitar. I didn't really date. I didn't really go out. Didn't really do much. And then I just worked two jobs. I worked at a Foot Locker, and I was a general manager for Singular Wireless. If any of the old folks out there remember Singular Wireless, I was there for a bit, and I worked, you know, just as many hours as I could get, just to earn as much as I could. And I had a lawn mowing business that I sold, and eventually just moved to Nashville when I was 20, just like 3 months before my 21st birthday, because I wanted to get acclimated before I started playing in the bars. Like, I wanted to learn my geography and learn where everywhere was, so I wasn't late to shows. And then when I turned 21, I just hit the ground running and hit up every venue, every place. And Nashville is where I really became a songwriter. I'd say that was my college. I didn't go to college, but that was definitely my challenging years, and the best way possible. I don't have any bad memories in Nashville. I really loved my time there, especially in the beginning. That was it was such an exciting adventure, you know. I'm learning the story. I'm sorry. Go ahead. So.
Oh no. I was just gonna kind of follow up on that, as I'm really curious what that looked like, because it is, especially for the kind of music that you do and being such a fan of country, that is like the mecca of songwriting.
Yeah,
really. So I'd love to hear more about that journey. Like, you mentioned kind of the getting there and it always being a desired destination. You'd been reading the books and such. Did you show up and go, I'm going the publishing route? What were you looking to do, and how'd you break in? Because that's like, it's a tough place because everyone goes there.
Sure. Well, you know, when I got there, I didn't know anybody. I think my first friend was the mailman. You know, I was like, you know, hey, I'm new to town. He's like, well, good for you. Here's your mail. You know, but I didn't know a whole lot. I loved watching those Behind the Musics and some of those kind of, you know, behind the scenes things that they would talk about with the different artists. And one place, a couple of places that kept coming up were Tootsie's, Orchid Lounge. You'd hear about Douglas Corner. You'd hear about, you know, some of those kind of staples. But then for myself, who was so passionate about songwriting, even at that age, the place to be as a songwriter was the Bluebird Cafe. And so I looked into it. I you know, I reached out to all those venues, but I was really excited about that one in particular. And so I looked into it, and there's such a there's a process to being accepted to perform, to be a part of the family there at the Bluebird. And you can only audition, I think it's every 3 months or maybe every 6 months now. I'm not sure. So there's a period where if you don't make it, you got to wait, you know.
Interesting.
So this place is it's incredible because it had like Taylor Swift was discovered there. Phil Vassar, Garth Brooks was discovered there. I mean, like Keith Urban, like you could go down the list of people who can connect to the Bluebird in a really powerful and meaningful way. So I thought, okay, this is the Mecca. That's the heart. That's the heartbeat of this whole place. If you can connect there, you can connect anywhere. And so I was so excited. Because I knew the history of the venue. So I was so excited before I ever auditioned there. And I was on the phone till like, you know, 2 a.m. with my family. Like, can you guys believe it? I'm here. We're doing it. I was supposed to get up, by 9 to get there by 9:30. And when I woke up, it was 9:15. So I jumped out of bed in one quick motion into my clothes, grabbed my keys. I was out the door and I was just flooring it all the way over there to the Bluebird. And when I got there, like, you know, obviously it's just my my cartoon memory remembering, but you know, it felt like there were songwriters, you know, laying out in the parking lot crying and tumbleweeds, like, you know, going
yeah.
But I opened the door and it's packed, every, you know, just, you know, packed to the rafters. And this person is still playing their song, and they, you know, they just ring out the last note, and I hear Amy Kurland, who at the time was on the venue, in the back. I heard her say, "Thank you so much for that. We'll let you know. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to audition?" And me and one other guy by the door raised our hands, and she said, "How long have you been here?" And I said, "A little while." You know, because that's not.
You're like, I've been in Nashville for a bit now.
Exactly. So she was like, all right, we'll let you try, we'll let you audition. So she dismissed everybody in the room, and me and the other guy sat down with her and her husband Kelly at a table, and the other songwriter, he played his song. And. And they were very polite and cordial and said, you know, we appreciate it. I think it needs a little more practice, but we'll let you know, you know, very polite. And then, so at that point, like, I'd seen 2 rejections in a row. I'm nervous. I'm starting to question myself. And they said, what's the name of, your song? And I said, well, it's called You Don't Know Jack About Jill. And they said, all right, well, let's hear a verse and a chorus of it. So I got into it, and, within a first, you know, first couple of lines, first couple of notes, they both were like, kind of like looking at each other, and she, you know, they were like comparing goosebumps with each other. It was really kind of a fun moment. But I was so terrified. I had my eyes closed so tight. I didn't want to look at them, because I was like, if they hate it, I'm going to screw up. I'm just, you know, and, anyways, I got through the first verse and chorus. They're like, well, keep going. We want to hear how this thing ends, you know? So I finished the track, the song, and then they dismissed the other songwriter, and so it was just me, them, and the bartender. And they said, "How long you been in town?" And I said, "Well, I've only been in town for about 3 months." I said, "I just got here. I'm working on trying to establish myself in the community, going to church, trying to do, you know, what I can." And they're like, "Well, we'd love to introduce you to some folks." And from there, they introduced me to amazing songwriters like Kent Blasey, who wrote everything with Garth Brooks, Karen Staley, who wrote several things for like George Strait and Tracy Byrd and Bob DePiro, who has like 18 or 19 number ones. And the bartender pulled me aside, and he said, "You know, I've known Amy for 25 years or 20 years or something." And he said, "I've never seen her ever use that leverage to try to connect anybody. I've never seen her do this before." So it was a very, very meaningful thing. And it really opened a lot of doors for me immediately in Nashville that I wouldn't have been able to just open for myself. So I'll always be grateful to Amy and Kelly there at the Bluebird. And of course, all those amazing writers too, for really helping me you know, kind of learn the ropes in those early Nashville days.
Is it true that you got to learn the number system to even go to a session?
You know, the Nashville number system is fun. I don't think it's necessary if you know the song. But yeah, I mean, if you're a session player, if you're a regular, you know, they call them side musicians. I really hate that term, but you know, guys that tour along with you, like, yeah, you gotta be sharp and on the fly. Like, if someone hollers out, play the five minor, you're like, A B C D. You don't know. You're gonna it's gonna throw you off a bit.
Well, thank you for sharing, because that's just like super inspiring, and literally it does sound like a movie that's made of just like coming through the door, like, I swear,
yeah,
I'm here.
Oh, I know. It was, and then it was the doors crazy. Open. You know, I gotta say, DB, it's been an interesting journey, but that's, you know, it really has been the road has been lined with experiences much like that one. You know, to where you just put yourself out there and risk it, like, you know, just take a chance, and it may fall on your ass, but you also may get to the next place, or maybe get to somewhere you really want to go. So take a risk. Take it.
Yeah. And that leads to a publishing deal. And do you mind walking folks through what that is? We've had some A&R folks on here, and folks that have had publishing deals as producers, but I don't actually know that we've had anybody that's been like a songwriter.
Oh, wow.
On publishing. So would you mind walking through what that looked like?
Yeah, sure. I think with just like any other industry, you have to produce. And much like several other industries, you know, you're not really appreciated for your efforts, just more or less your results. And so if you produce regularly, consistently quality products, then you're gonna be in business. And so what I did, you know, in those early days, especially right at the end of high school, and before, just as I moved to Nashville, I made it a point to write a song every day, but I couldn't use the same chords or even the same words from the day before. Like, ooh. I would have to change it up every time so that it would be something different. So if I wrote something in a major, I'd do something in a minor the next day. If I wrote a happy song, I wrote a sad, you know, whatever. So I would just switch it up until I had all of these songs under my belt. And then I would go to the open mic nights and I would test them out. And if people would be just hanging on every word, then I knew that I had something that, you know, would be maybe a beneficial thing to take into a meeting. And so I had been playing what I call the five-hour cities outside of Nashville. If you look at Nashville, it looks like a big wagon wheel, you know, with all the different highways and interstates kind of intersecting there and kind of spurring off. And if you go 4 hours, you know, east, you'll end up in Carolinas. If you go up north, you'll be in Cincinnati. And down south, you've got Atlanta. East or west, rather, you got Memphis and gosh, what's the name of that in Mississippi? There's a kind of a casino type place out there. I'm blanking on it, but you could travel, you know, 5 hours to these different places. And so I was out on the road, and my girlfriend at the time had said, "Hey, I met this publisher, and he's heard of you, and he'd really like to meet you." And I said, "Wow, that sounds great. Yeah, I'd love to talk." So I think she was shopping for a publishing deal at the time as well. And so he introduced, you know, she introduced us, and he asked me, he said, if I asked you to bring me in a song a week, do you think you could do it? And at that point, I'd already been writing a song a day. And I said, yeah, I think I can do that, you know? And so instead of bringing just one, I would bring in five songs that were completely different every week to him. So after about 2 months of writing 20, 40, 50 songs that were all different.
Wow.
He was like, we want to offer you an exclusive publishing deal. And I said, I'd love to look at that. And so you know, with publishing deals, it's not like a day job where you get paid an hourly wage. You agree on a contracted sum. They give you what's called an advance, and they allow you to utilize your time to write. Now, it's sometimes your advances are enough to cover your costs, and depending on the publishing deal, depending on the publishing company, sometimes it allows you to live off of that exclusively. Others, it's kind of like the minor leagues in baseball. You get to, you know, you get what you get, and you like it.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah.
But this was a very fair deal, to where it allowed me the freedoms to not only write more regularly, but also pursue music full time with other venues, creating relationships, freeing up that time that would otherwise be required of me to work at a day job. It freed up a lot of it was finally the kind of break that I needed to really kind of get my footing in the business. And then from there, you know, I worked for Surefire Music Company, which is the oldest publishing company in Nashville, that dates back all the way to the 1950s. And like one of their first writers was Loretta Lynn. So I'd had the pleasure of meeting her several times, and she even cooked us a breakfast one time, which was kind of neat. But you know, when you have that history, you really appreciate the art, the business, the musicians within that business. You don't, you know, it's fascinating to me when you hear someone refer to an artist and they'll say something like that. I don't like it. It sucks, or, you know, and I think about, regardless of how, you know, like how that vibration or how that artist made you feel, they turn someone on in a way that no one else does. Otherwise they wouldn't be there, you know? Mm-hmm. And I appreciate all of that hard work and dedication that artist applies and commits to. Because it's not just I'm gonna put out one song and see if the audience likes it, and then I'll keep putting out more songs like it or whatever. You know, it really is like, if as an artist you have to have something to say, you have to have something to, you know, that you're convicted about. Otherwise you're just, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it doesn't seem as I guess committed. I don't really know what the word is here. It just seems very hollow, you know, like if there's no heart behind the message, what's the message? What's the purpose? What's the meaning? But that's, you know, maybe a little bit of songwriter purist talking there. I don't know. I just know that in Nashville, I really learned how to appreciate the songwriting, and I really grew as a writer there, to where I finished as the head staff writer after I was there for 5 years. And then I started my own publishing company, the TSDC Music Group, after the fifth year, once I learned all the ropes and learned what's necessary with doing publishing, and it's just been able to take off with that, and I've been running that for 7 years now, 8 years, seven, 8 years now.
That's awesome. What made you want to start your own firm? Obviously there's a lot of business benefit to doing so, but as someone who was writing a song a day, what made you go, you know what, I also want to tackle this side over here?
It's interesting. I guess, you know, after a while, when you do something long enough, you want to do more. You want to expand. You don't want to stay in the same place. You want to keep growing. And I felt that I'd learned, you know, significantly about songwriting, you know, playing, composition, music, all that kind of stuff. And I knew that in order to survive it, I had to kind of create my own music business, my own music industry. Every artist, I think, is responsible for kind of creating their own, what would you call it? Their own environment, their own environment to grow. And so I read a book from Arnold Schwarzenegger called Total Recall. And in it, he talks about starting off as a military man. Then he was a bricklayer. Then he was in real estate. Then he was a bodybuilder. Then he was a movie actor. Then he was a governor. But the whole trend throughout the whole thing was that he got antsy after a while, and he craved more. He craved, he thirsted for more knowledge, for more responsibility. And I think as time goes on, as we grow older, I've really fallen in love. I've always been, in love with the business and the science of everything. But I think also, one of my mentors was a man named Jerry Weintraub. And I didn't know Jerry very well. We only met shortly, but before he passed, unfortunately. He was an incredible man. He managed John Denver, Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra. But he was very generous with his time, and I would ask, I would call him. I never met him in person, but I would always call him, and I just reach out every like I reached out every single day. Like, I was like, I want to meet this guy. I want to meet this guy. I want to meet this guy. So I just hammered his phone lines for like a month solid every day. Just, hey, let him know Brian James called. Let him know Brian James. Hey, Brian James is calling. Just every day. So every day, when just like he did to Colonel Tom Parker to get him to take Elvis on the road, eventually he was like, the name was in his brain, and so he would call me, and we'd talk. And he did like Ocean's 13, 11, like all those movies, and he really kind of laid out a different mindset, a different perspective of not only the industry, but business and marketing, and just different, just a different way to approach life even. Like, it was, so I think, ultimately, like, I was influenced by mentors that I respected, and it encouraged me to kind of keep taking that next risk, keep taking that next chance, because they were right there beside me, kind of holding my hand through the process. Like, yeah, if you do this, this is going to be the result. I mean, you're going to learn what you're going to learn, and it's good. It was a very healthy, productive time in my life, to where, and there's even things in the future that I contemplate doing in business that don't relate to music in any way, which I'm also very excited about. But I knew with music, as hard as it is, I knew it was necessary to understand beyond just the instrumentation, beyond just the music. Like, there's a business, and then there's the music. And together they make the music business, but you can't have one without the other.
Yeah. Oh, that's so true. Frankly, brings us to kind of where we are today, is that you've got so much going on. So I'd love to dive in. And we've talked so much about what's leading up. Like, obviously COVID hits and like live shows go away. So that's beating a dead horse at this point. But you've got a lot of shows on the docket. So do you mind walking through what the summer looks like for you, what you've got going on, and let people know, of course, where they can find you so they can check out all this amazing stuff you're doing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, of course. Yeah, we've got we're really spreading our wings out. I think COVID has encouraged that. Initially, when I came back to Washington, my dad had just had heart surgery, and so I'd came home to kind of help the family out. And now that he's gotten better over time, and I can kind of branch out and do more shows, we're starting to get out more regionally. We're doing some stints out in Oregon, Idaho. We're doing some pretty big shows here in Seattle over the summer, all of which are listed on the website at BrianJamesWasHere.com. And yeah, of course, we're doing the national anthem. We're in talks with a couple of other major league teams as well to, because I'm such a baseball fan. Right?
I was going to say, as you being a huge baseball fan, that's got to be in New York City.
You know, it's amazing. I was blessed and fortunate to do the national anthem at the Mets last year on my birthday, but it was at the end of a very long season. I think they may have just fallen out of first place at the very end of the season, and it was like the first of a doubleheader where it had rained that morning, so there weren't a lot of fans
there. You got the angry New Yorker vibe in the stands.
for sure, but everybody there, you know, was so sweet, and the staff was incredible, and they said, you know, we'd love to invite you again back this year. So this year they reached out and invited me to come back for 4th of July weekend, which outside of All-Star week, that's one of the biggest weekends for baseball because it's America's pastime and it's our national holiday. So, and the Mets have a great team this year. I'm really excited for them. I'm really happy that they got that amazing pitching staff going together. But yeah, I love baseball, and this has been a dream of mine. I sang the national anthem at the Seahawks on Monday Night Football a couple years ago.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. It was right in the middle of all the controversy where players were taking, you know, their stance, and others, you know, political parties were taking their stance. So it was really kind of a hot button topic. And again, I was out on the road, and someone, they said, we're doing Monday Night Football. Could you send us a copy of you performing? And so I did, with my cell phone. I just sang it in the car.
Sent
it to them, and they said, okay, well, we'd love to come have you do the national anthem. So so I get there, and the stadium, it's packed. I think like 70,000 people maybe in the stadium, and then another 23 million people on live TV saw it. So it was an experience. It was really something. And that stadium, you could have heard a pin drop. It was so quiet. Like it was like, you know, right. You know how loud Seattle gets, you know. And it was so quiet. You could hear a pin drop. I could hear myself breathing with those in-ear monitors. Like I could just hear my,
oh gosh.
And I look up, and there's this, like Jumbotron, at the back of the stadium. And all I see is just the shadow of some guy going, yeah.
not fitting the vibe at all.
And it totally put me at ease. totally put me at ease, and I was like, all right, we got it, you know. And then I just broke into it, but I was nervous the week before. I had a terrible cold, and I was nervous my voice wasn't going to show up that day, but thank goodness it did. And that's what got me in the door with all these others, was I was able to reach out and say, this is my audition from the Monday Night Football and all that. And it opened up a few more doors as well. So we're talking to a couple more teams. You know, nothing solidified, but it's my dream to perform the anthem for all 30 baseball stadiums, because I've always wanted to go to all 30 stadiums. And so my goal is to try to go after all 30 of the baseball stadiums.
Perfect way to tackle that. Like, A, I'm an incredible singer. B, I'm a huge baseball fan.
Totally,
so.
Oh, I love it. It's such a great sport. It's a great release too. Like, as you know, you got to have a hobby outside of music or outside of your everyday thing, and baseball is definitely that release for me, for sure.
Oh, that's awesome. Which of the stadiums that you have not played yet are you most excited to play? Well, so I shouldn't say potentially. You're gonna play. Which of the baseball teams you have not played yet are you most excited to play?
Well, the diplomatic answer is everybody. Yeah, everybody. but I grew up in Seattle, so I mean, I was a '90s kid, and we had A-Rod and Junior and Griffey and Edgar and the Unit. Like we had an elite group of players that. My grandpa would take us up and watch regularly, and I fell in love with the Mariners from the time I was a boy, and have stayed loyal. I watch, I watch just about as, you know, as many games. I at least catch the scores at the end of every night when they're playing. I really do. I'm not a fair weather fan. It's a couple years ago when I think they were in the middle of a 100 loss season. I saw another guy in a parking lot, and I was wearing a Mariners shirt, and he had a Mariners hat. And we just were like, ah, you know, like the
yeah, it's like we're like still
that,
here,
like that Spider-Man meme, like ah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say if I had to, you know, the Mariners are obviously my hometown team, anytime I play like MLB The Show, I always am a Mariner, so I definitely.
Well, here's what we're going to do when this podcast goes live. We're going to have plenty of clips from this to show. We're going to be tagging the Mariners, and I need to get that Monday Night Football tape from you, and we're just going to run it, and we're just going to be like, "All right, Mariners. Here it is. Here's the proof. We're going to make it happen. We're going to make this happen. The interwebs are going to help us out on this one." This has been a true pleasure. I have a section for you before we wrap. I'm going to rapid fire, and you tell me your preferences here. So we're going to go James Taylor or John Mayer.
Ouch. Rapid fire, James Taylor.
Phil Vassar or Billy Joel?
Billy Joel.
Audio Slave or Rascal Flatts?
Audio Slave. I'd say Audio Slave.
Ooh. About this one, Hattie B's or Prince's?
Ooh. Hattie B's.
I lost my Hattie B's hat and I'm devastated. Where it all got started, can you finish the lyric? Amy.
What you gonna do? I think I could stay with you.
Yeah. That, no joke, was a song that was such a big part of my childhood. I don't think we had the Pure Prairie League records. My dad would sing that all the time. So when you sent me that was like kind of your initial foyer into the road, I was like, no way. So, and then when you sang the guitar part earlier, I was like, that's it. It was that song. It's Amy.
Such a great song. I mean, I heard it, like I said, on one of those compilation discs. And I, you know, as a kid who grew up in the country, obviously I love country music. But when I heard that song, I was like, oh, that's the jam right there. I got to learn that.
Mm-hmm. You could crush that too. Like with oh man. And I got to gas you up a little bit before we wrap, is I listen to your latest record all the time. The Brian James and the Great Unknown, The Journey of 1,000 Miles is always on repeat. It's on my writing inspiration playlist. So if anything is incidentally similar, please do not sue me. I'm just kidding. I know you own all your publishing. So
that's funny.
In the grand scheme of things, I know we've talked a lot about the journey. At the end of the day, why do you make music?
You know, DB, I've given it a lot of thought, and there's a lot of things in life that I'm passionate about. You know, I could do some kind of engineering or maybe even management or some avenue in business. But someone once told me, they said, the reason a songbird sings is because it was born to. And so I can't imagine my life any other way. I was born to do it, and I would be robbing myself of a life that I was meant to live had I not pursued this.
Oh, I love that. And then the flip side, what do you hope people get out of your music?
You know, I hope that they connect to it in a real way, in a way that's more than just superficial. You know, I want people to, my hope is that there are people out there who hear it and at wherever they are in life can relate to it. And if they feel alone or they feel vulnerable in a world that seems to care less and less, there's one voice out there somewhere that cares. There's one voice out there that still has a heartbeat for them and can relate to them and understands what they're going through and what they're dealing with. And they're not alone. They've actually got a whole nation of people that are just like them, that appreciate people just like them. And I just hope that it makes them feel at ease in a world where that's not always the easiest thing to do.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for doing this. It was a genuine pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure, man.
And then one more time before we wrap, I know you dropped the site name, but where can folks find you?
BrianJamesWasHere.com.
Awesome. Thank you again. This is wonderful. I can't wait to bump all this stuff you've got going. We're going to get you at T-Mobile Park.
Let's do it.
ASAP.
I'm in. I appreciate it. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and visit with you a little bit here, DB. This has been fun.
Yeah, I'm so glad. I'm glad we were able to connect. And frankly, I've wanted to have this conversation for a long time. So I'm very glad it worked out.
Yeah, me too.
Cheers. Shouts out to Brian for being on Made for Music. Be sure to check out his new album, Sessions, under the name Brian James Was Here, wherever you get your tunes. My personal favorite at the moment is Ghost Town, the final track of the record. And to stay up to date with all things Brian James, visit brianjameswashere.com. We've also got to get this man to sing the national anthem at a Mariners game, so if you are listening and you've got the connect, be sure to hit him up. And if you dig what you hear on the podcast, brought to you by Stitch Records, the only place I trust to mix my tunes, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Music, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. I truly appreciate the extra effort, and I'll see you next time.